At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
So then we come to Canto the Second, as it's laid out here. Now, obviously, just to say, these first two cantos were written simultaneously and published both together in 1812. And actually, at the very end of the second canto, he says something along the lines of, oh, and if you'd like to read more about Childe Harold's pilgrimage, then perhaps the writer might in the future revisit it, which he obviously goes on to do. But these are written in very different personal circumstances to the later cantos.
Quite different voicing as well.
Yes, definitely. So, of course, those later cantos were written under very different personal circumstances. But for this one, you immediately feel the passion of it because, of course, Byron was, for all intents and purposes, Philhellenic. He was someone who adored Greece. He adored antiquity.
Well, basically every stanza in this poem has got a reference or two to ancient Greece.
Yeah. And so him coming to Greece for the first time and seeing the genuine dismay and the broken spirit of the Greek people after 400 years of Ottoman Turk occupation was really crushing to him. He hated to see a people who had not just been once proud and innovative, but, as far as he saw, the cradle of all that was good and moral and, you know, and the arts, the literature, the cultural developments that Greece obviously contributed to, its political representation in Athenian democracy, all of these sorts of things Byron obviously doted on.
Yeah.
And so to see them all bastardized and taken away. And one of the things that he comments on originally, because these first few stanzas, he starts talking about the Acropolis in Athens. And one of the things that I think is actually very cutting is the fact that it's not that the Turk is going around desecrating these places. It's the fact that he's indifferent to them.
Yes.
Because they're not his civilization. It's not his people's achievements.
Stanza, sorry, if you wanted to start
earlier,
I'm going to read out stanza 10.
Sure.
Here lets me sit upon this massy stone, the marble columns yet unshaken base. Here, son of Saturn, was thy favourite throne. Mightiest of many such, hence let me trace the latent grandeur of thy dwelling place. It may not be, nor even can fancy's eye restore what time hath laboured to deface. Yet these proud pillars claim no passing sigh, unmoved the Muslim sits, the light Greek carols by. So it's not only the Turks, it's the Greeks as well, who are indifferent. If you've read Island of Four, you'll know what the Fellahina are.
Yeah, I might.
That is the Fellahina right there.
Right.
Which, again, goes on to be developed by Spengler and the beat poets took that up in the 50s and 60s, Jacques Kerouac especially.
Yeah. Just people who've been entirely removed from any sense of history or their presence in it.
They do not understand the context.
No.
So it's if the goat herd is in the on the Roman forum and all that. Yeah.
But obviously this is entirely helpful for the occupying Ottomans
Yeah.
Because it's in actually recovering, and this is what Byron invokes throughout this canto time and time again. Remember who you are.
Mm.
Remember your history. Remember your strength. Remember what you're able to achieve.
Yeah.
Because he wants to snap them out of that malaise, that fellaheen state.
Bring the conversation down. But Marx, this is where Marx traces... For Marx, there's two romantic poets, really, Byron and Percy Shelley. And this is where he sees in Byron. If Byron had lived, Byron would have become a conservative.
Mm.
He would have become the Spenglerian.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Marx didn't say that because obviously Spengler was after Marx, but that's what Byron would have become.
Mm.
He would have become a reactionary. Mm.
As Coleridge did in his later life.
And Marx sees it as a good thing that he died when he did, because he didn't devolve into that, as opposed to Shelley, who was on his way to and would have become a revolutionary.
Mm.
Right? Because Marx sees Shelley as the revolutionary out of the two of them.
Right.
And that's where his thought was going.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you can see evidence for that throughout, particularly Canto 2.
Yeah,
definitely. So let's start here. So he's at the Acropolis in Athens, and he begins the second canto by saying in the second stanza of it, "Ancient of days, August Athena, where are thy men of might, thy grand in soul, gone, glimmering through the dream of things that were? First in the race that led to glory's goal, they won and passed away. Is this the whole? A schoolboy's tale, the wonder of an hour, the warrior's weapon and the sophist stole, are sought in vain, and o'er each mouldering tower, dim with the mist of years, grey flits the shade of power. Son of the morning, rise, approach you here. Come, but molest not yon defenceless urn. Look on this spot, a nation's sepulchre, abode of gods, whose shrines no longer burn. Even gods must yield, religions take their turn. 'Twas Jove's, 'tis Mahomet's, and other creeds will rise with other years, till man shall learn. Vainly his incense soars, his victim bleeds. Poor child of doubt and death, whose hope is built on reeds." Tremendous. Just absolutely tremendous. And I love the fact that he's also appealing to the fact here he's invoking the old Olympian gods, right? His those old pagan rituals and worship. And he's saying, even these, almighty Zeus, once thought to be eternal and governor of all the world, even he is a passing thing.
Now?
Where are they now? With these abandoned temples, all of these things, you know, fallen into disrepute. No one's worshipping there anymore because no one believes. And again, so it just speaks to that consistent theme of the poem of just a state of impermanence and the fragility.
Marx, all that is solid turns to dust.
Yeah, the fragility of civilization.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all there. And as well, as they say, the race that led to glory's goal, you know, in his eyes, the first... to achieve something to be truly proud of. I mean, to be fair here, I think, once again, this speaks to Byron's biases, and he certainly has. On the one hand, in Canto 1, you get a total departure from idealism. He's just looking at things in grim reality.
Yeah.
Whereas when he's dealing with the Greeks... it's all romance. You were the first people, you know, you were so freeing, you fought the Persians, as if the Athenians didn't start colonies around the entirety of the Mediterranean.
It's more like a displaced idealism, because fundamentally he thinks the Greeks can be reborn and return to what they were.
Yeah.
But right now he's dealing with the horror of how far they've fallen, really.
Mm. It's a grievous wound to him.
So the gods have disappeared. He's trying to call the Greek to remember himself.
Mm.
He's begging them to wake up, in a sense. He then, another memento mori comes into this, which is probably my favourite one out of the entire piece.
Yeah.
And the one that's most deliberate, I think. He says, bear in mind there's always all these remnants of Greek civilization around and
yes.
whatnot. In stanza 5, or burst the vanished hero's lofty mound. Far on the solitary shore he sleeps. He fell, and falling nations mourned around, but now not one of the sounding thousand weeps, nor warlike worshipper his vigil keeps, where demigods appeared, as records tell. Remove yon skull from out of the scattered heaps. Is that a temple where a god may dwell? Why even the worm at last disdains her shattered cell? So he's saying, this king under the mound, or whoever this person was, this person who represented a concrete institution, something concrete back then, now even his skull, which is the kind of seat of the soul, the seat of the mind, is now occupied by a worm who doesn't even recognize it as a skull.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Yeah, it's powerful imagery. And also as well, you get to the point where, especially with that part about where it says, but now not one of saddening thousands weep. And this is not just true of Greece as well. This is obviously true of the entire Christian world. In 1453, with the fall of Constantinople to, you know, Mehmed II, obviously the entire Christian world fell into a state of shock and despair. Now, why the shock? I'm not entirely sure, given that the writing was on the wall and there'd been options available for decades to try and help the Byzantines, who were obviously, you know, dwindling to this final rump of an empire that had once stood since Rome.
Well, I mean, you can make the argument the Catholic Church didn't want it to survive.
Well, you could also make the argument, I suppose, that if the Catholic Church forced it to survive, they could change the religion of it. Wow. But nonetheless, anyway, one for the historians. The point is that this entire idea of weeping, this passivity that has now entirely gone about, and also as well, you know, this idea that certain events seem to happen in history, and 1453 is a great example of this, where this, I mean, for many historians, that moment marks the beginning of the early modern period, right? It is...
Well, it's the end of the medieval age, isn't it?
The end of the medieval age and the beginning of the early modern. Mm. And by extent, the beginning of the time period of modernism, of modern life that we now too are but vessels of. And also the fact that, well, in all of this weeping, where are the tears 400 years on for Greece, now after it got captured by the Ottomans? He's talking about the fact that all of these civilizations, not just Greece, but all of them around, who by rights should have every interest in seeing a free and independent Greece, not only because you obviously want to weaken a powerful Muslim empire, but also as well, are we so uncaring about the Western cradle of civilization that we would leave it in the hands of these Turks, that we would leave the Greeks in a state of slavery and submission? Does Greece mean so little to us that we wouldn't shed a tear over that being its future as it has been for the past 400 years? And so I think it's not just a critique of the Greek spirit and their lack of willingness to rebel, though of course that is right around the corner, nor of the Ottomans, but also of the wider West and its ambivalence about the future of Greece.
Sorry to use a pun, but it opens a whole can of worms as to whether Greece was really of the West. Yeah, and this is what Spengler and all these people since have contended with.
Right.
You know, is the West we know as Western Europe, Britain, Germany, France, is that the same thing as Greece? Is it of the same lineage, or is it something entirely different?
Well,
although carrying over the philosophy and the artworks and whatnot.
Yes. Well, I mean that's a question that obviously comes to be answered just after Byron's lifetime, I suppose. With all of the Western powers, France and Britain, finally intervening, and let's not deny it. I'm not saying it was all of the reason, but for better or worse. To come back to what you were saying about Marx and Byron, the fact that Byron did die at Missolonghi in the Greek War of Independence, and the fact that he hadn't been back to Britain, he personally self-exiled himself from it for nearly a decade, is the fact that the public anguish at the fact that this man had thrown himself into what was seen as such a pure and glorious and noble moment of rebellion, you know, was something that plagued on the public's heartstrings.
Yeah.
Enough to kind of galvanize public sentiment in Britain for the Greek War of Independence and the Allies interceding in it.
There is a strain of thinking.
There always is.
Which I've seen, which is that Byron was actually a British intelligence asset.
Mm.
And he was there essentially as a spy. You know, he's basically James Bond already.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was there for a specific reason, and this was something the British wanted to do.
Mm.
So there is a kind of materialist geopolitical lens you could put onto it and say, actually, he was there because they were going to intervene anyway.
Mm.
So,
well, you could, but I, whenever we get into discussions like that,
not that I don't want to get into that. I'm just saying.
Yeah. But I mean, normally we have those sorts of discussions over a few pints at the pub about whether or not there was a materialistic reason for an economic reason, or whether there was like a more of a sentimental virtue for something.
It's probably a bit of both.
Of course it is.
Because
I don't think anyone can deny the fact that Byron didn't believe.
Oh, no, 100%. You know?
So what we were going to say was, then we get to a part where he turns his pen against the British again.
Mm.
In stanza 11, where he says, "But who, of all the plunderers of yon fane, on high where Pelas lingered, loth to flee, the latest relic of her ancient reign, the last, the worst, dull spoiler, who was he? Blush, Caledonia, such thy son could be. England, I joy no child he was of thine. Thy free-born men could spare what once was free. Yet they could violate each saddening shrine and bear these altars o'er the long reluctant brine. But most modern Picts' ignoble boast to rive what Goth and Turk and time hath spared, cold as a crag upon his native coast, his mind as barren and his heart as hard, is he whose head conceived, whose hand prepared, ought to displace Athena's poor remains, her sons too weak the sacred shrine to guard, yet felt some portion of their mother's pains, and never knew till then the weight of despot's chains. What? Shall it e'er be said by British tongue, Albion was happy in Athena's tears, though in thy name the slaves her bosom wrung, till not the deed to blushing Europe's ears? The ocean queen, the free Britannia, bears the last poor plunderer from a bleeding land. Yes, she, whose generous aid her name endears, tore down those remnants with a harpy's hand, which envious eld forbore and tyrants left to stand." It's powerful stuff. For those of you who couldn't quite follow along with the floweriness of his language, he's talking about the Elgin Marbles.
He's talking about Elgin.
Right, and Elgin specifically. Right?
Blush Caledonia.
The Caledonia.
Such thy son could
be. Picked. The bloody Picts, eh, Rory?
As a fellow Picts, I do not like Elgin.
But he's calling out the removal of the Elgin Marbles, right, and taking them back to Britain, which at the time of writing this had only happened about a decade prior.
Yeah.
And he's really, and I have to say, I entirely agree with Byron on this point. I do. What he's saying is, look, this is a land that is already at its lowest low. It is already a land that is at the depths of a lack of self-belief, a lack of spirit, a lack of vitality, no consideration for its former glories or its strength or what it could achieve, and has been subjugated for the past 400 years. And you're coming here like a common looter, kicking them while they're already fully down, and now taking what few precious things they still have left.
Yes, the Brits did it everywhere they went. Egypt. There is now an obelisk standing on the side of the River Thames.
Oh, yes, I've seen it.
An ancient Egyptian one.
Mm.
Its sister is in New York, I think.
Right.
But yeah, I know a lot of people. I remember a couple of years ago, or 3 years ago, 4 years ago, when I used to do news reports, there was a lot of right-wingers crying about potentially sending the Elgin Marbles back.
Mm.
They never should have been taken, in my opinion.
Well, no, I agree with that entirely. One thing I suppose to actually just have a bit of a conversation about this, because I'd like to, is the fact that as well, when you look at, it's funny in a way, because as he says there, you know, in that stanza, he talks about the fact that there was no Greek to guard it, to say no, to say, actually, this belongs to us. There was obviously a deal made between Lord Elgin and his associates and the Turkish administration.
Yeah.
But the Greeks were not consulted on this. And I suppose the point about basically exploiting the Greeks at their weakest moment is actually a feeling that we in turn know ourselves now very well as well. When we actually look back, to go back to what you were saying about the culture wars and whether or not Britain should remove this thing or that thing or give back this, that or the other from the British Museum, my answer would be I would deal with it case by case, right? That is genuinely my answer. But one of the reasons why I think it rankled so many people, and rightly so, and I agree with them on this, is because we ourselves were being exploited at a moment of enormous national weakness. This was not a healthy, robust British society having a serious conversation about what we owed to other nations. This was entirely a result of incessant left-wing like campaigning in which they always like knee-jerk side with the foreigners in every instance. And so these are not the same thing. You know, it's one thing for the British to say, we will give you back the Elgin marbles. It's one thing for a committee made up of people who have no ancestry in Britain, you know, beyond the last 40 years, dictating for us about where our national conversation is going to go.
To be fair, I think a lot of it comes from white people within academia. To be honest, the social context of modern-day Britain, I don't think Byron would agree with.
No, I don't.
However, I think the Elgin Marbles point he would agree with. There is an element of hypocrisy in it still. And again, Byron was socially progressive in a not strictly modern sense.
Yeah.
You know, it was Yeah.
But there's a note here that I wanted to read actually from one of these passages where Byron himself writes, I cannot resist availing myself of the permission of my friend Dr. Clark, whose name requires no comment with the public, but whose sanction will add tenfold weight to my testimony, to insert the following extract from a very obliging letter of his to me as a note to the above lines. Quote, when the last of the metopes was taken from the Parthenon, and in moving of it, a great part of the superstructure, with one of triglyphs, was thrown down by the workmen whom Lord Elgin employed, the Dizdar, who's kind of like the Turkish fortress commander, who beheld the mischief done to the building, took his pipe from his mouth, dropped a tear, and said in a supplicating tone of voice, said to Luceri, I was present. The Dizdar alluded to was the father of the present Dizdar.
Yeah, wow.
And so even the Turk is just there like, what are you doing?
I could see in one of these... in one of these stanzas, I can't remember exactly which one, but he's talking about how they've been there, these things.
Mm.
You know, apart from the Parthenon exploding, which he doesn't mention, but...
No, he does.
Oh, he does?
He talks about, when the Venetians...
Oh, right,
in the 1600s, very briefly.
Right.
He does mention it.
Anyway, there's a stanza in here where he says they've been there for, you know, basically a millennia without either Greek or Turk harming them.
Yeah.
As soon as the Brits arrive, not only do they steal them...
Mm.
They graffiti everything as well.
Yeah.
Right.
And also as well, the removal work is so shoddy.
Yeah.
The triglyphs are just falling off as well.
Yeah.
And so just total disregard for it. And so obviously, point's been made. Byron obviously cared about this a great deal. As we move forward as well, I suppose we should start talking about the fact as if we come to... Oh, yes, here we are. Stanza 16. But where is Harold... Shall I then forget to urge the gloomy wanderer o'er the wave? Little recked he of all that men regret, no loved one now in feigned lament could rave, no friend the parting hand extended gave, ere the cold stranger passed to other climes, hard is his heart whom charms may not enslave. But Harold felt not, as in other times, and left without a sigh the land of war and crimes. And so we introduce Harold back into the story again, and this is one of the things that from this moment on, the entire pretense, you can tell, already, bear in mind, again, this is written at the same time as the canto. The whole pretext of this being Harold's journey just keeps kind of like coming and going until the point where you almost forget Harold within all of this.
It really reminds me of a Philip K. Dick novel called Valis.
I'm not familiar with it.
Well, you should it's quite similar. Like,
right.
There's basically like four just protagonists, including PKD himself, and it just kind of flits between them. It's weird. The stanza before that, again, he's talking about British hands stealing things, walls defaced, mouldering shrines removed, and snatch thy shrinking gods to northern climes abhorred. The gods have been snatched away to London.
Yes.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to FinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.